Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Welcome back to Magic TV. I am here with another Talk Magic, and I'm actually interviewing today one of my favorite magicians. I've spoken about the Buena Vista Shuffle Club on this channel an awful lot, and I have the author of the Buena Vista Shuffle Club, an amazing magician, Matt Baker. Matt, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm great, Craig. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you so much for coming on the channel. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Happy to be here.
And I'm really excited that you are, because for anybody who's been on this channel for quite a while, I talk about you a lot. I talk about your magic an awful lot. And you're one of the people that I wanted to get on this channel right from the very, very beginning. And I think one of the reasons is your magic has such an impact on me, because you do a lot of Memdeck magic, which is fantastic, because that's something that I'm very into. But B, your routines are so well thought out. You combine really clever principles that a lot of people haven't seen before with sleight of hand, and you create these routines and these creations that are quite unique. And I'd really like to talk to you about all of that and the creativity process. But I'd like to start at the very beginning, first of all.
Sure.
And find out just a little bit more about you. So when did you get into magic, if you don't mind me asking? Was it as a child or a little bit later on?
Yeah, I was about 10 years old. And I think I was interested earlier, because we have a photo of me with a magician at my birthday party when I was 4 years old. So I guess already at that time, I don't know if I asked for that or that was the first time I saw a magician. I don't remember. But I guess I've been interested in a long time. I was about 10 when I started doing magic, buying kits and practicing and showing my parents and my friends. And then as a teenager, I did birthday parties and, you know, pretty much the same origin story that we all have. But then I sort of stopped. I mean, I was into a lot of things. I had a lot of hobbies all throughout my life, and magic was one of them. But other things took over for a while. I got serious about my studies and launching a career and getting married, and I sort of didn't do much magic. But then around age 30, when I had my first kid, I got back into it, and it really took off. And I just decided that I was going to drop all my other hobbies. And I only had time for what, you know, with a family and a job, I really only have time for one hobby. And I just decided it's going to be magic. So I stopped playing guitar, which I like to do. And I stopped some of the writing that I like to do. And I used to be really into trivia. I was on Jeopardy when I was in my 20s. But I just quit all of that, basically, and decided to focus on magic.
That must have been a big deal for you, because I've done some research and I found out a lot about you, and you have written in the past your own original songs, and you've done a lot of poetry writing. So to put a pin in that and move away from that and just focus solely on magic, that must have been a big decision at the time.
It was. And I'm not saying I don't do any of those things at all anymore, but you know, I mean, I only have time for one serious hobby, right? Like something I'm actually trying to be good at.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as I like to sing and play guitar, I mean, that's not where my talent that stands out among the world of, you know, 7 billion people is. And I guess at some point I decided I could actually be good at magic if I put my mind to it. You know, it never really even occurred to me when I was younger. I just did it because I thought it was fun and my friends liked it at parties and stuff, but it never really occurred to me to be serious about it. When I was a kid, I didn't do any serious practicing, you know, but I just decided this is actually something people enjoy a lot. It's a lot more rare than someone who can play guitar. And it's something I really have enjoyed since I was a kid. And so I just thought, you know, let's run with this, and started putting more time into it, reading more, watching videos, learning who the great magicians are, practicing moves, thinking about stuff. And sure enough, I mean, I got better over time.
Absolutely. And I want to talk an awful lot about the influences in your magic career. But before I do, let's just touch on your job, because you are a maths professor at Georgia Tech. Is that right?
Or Georgia? Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And
Georgia Tech.
And let me ask you a question. Has a background in mathematics influenced your magic at all?
In terms of the creation?
Because I see a lot of, yeah. I just wondered if there was also some sort of crossover there. And, you know, because I do see that, especially a lot of the routines I see you do, there is a lot of mathematics, not all the time, but there are certain principles that require sort of looking at things in a very different way. And I'm guessing that might be through your love of mathematics as well.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's something where it does have a real nice overlap, crossover with magic. You know, my job and my hobby, they go quite well together, but they complement each other too. I'm not really interested in only doing mathematical card tricks. You know, that feels very limiting to me. Mm-hmm. And I'd much rather use all the skills I have together in magic. So I think I can do certain, I don't know, calculations in my head that other people seem to find hard. And for me, it's just easy. So I use that when I can. I mean, I do a version of any card to any number that, you know, apparently some of my friends find the subtraction you have to do to be difficult. And for me, that's just, that comes naturally. So I use that when I invent tricks. I know about a lot of principles, and I know how to sit down and analyze a problem, break down what I'm trying to get to, what the difficulties are. You know, it's like doing research in mathematics. But also my teaching of mathematics has had a big impact, I think, because I'm used to standing in front of a bunch of people and talking. It makes me more relaxed when I'm performing. And it makes me a better teacher that I have experience going out and doing magic for people. You know, I think a lot of teachers don't have any performing experience. And to me, that's a mistake. I mean, there's so much to study in the world of theater, in the world of performing arts, that really helps you communicate better. I'll give you a quick example. Something I learned from Juan Tamariz, which we can talk more about, you know, him and his influence later. But in the 5 points of magic, he has a bunch of tips on performance, which include things as simple sounding as standing up straight with your feet at a 45-degree angle, and turning your body like this when you make eye contact with people, rather than moving your feet. You know, keep your feet planted. Well, in fact, I had read this before. It made sense to me, but I never really incorporated that. It was just one of those things like, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And then when I went and studied with Juan in Spain, which we can talk about, he videotaped the group of us. There were five of us there at his house for 4 days. And on the third night, he videotaped us performing. And then the next day he critiqued our performances. And the magic that I did, he said, oh, wonderful, very nice. And then he spent 15 minutes talking about my feet and the position of my feet. Just not at all as I was expecting out of going to Spain and studying with Juan. But tell you what, not only has that improved my magic performance since then, but my teaching as well. Maybe not now, because I'm teaching online this semester, but you know, when I'm standing in front of a classroom, I do have a tendency to sway back and forth, and I think it's just distracting. And I'm really trying to focus on that now that it was brought to my attention that this is the one main critique, you know, that the great Juan Tamariz had. So I think it just goes very well with my job, that the things I learn as a teacher, I apply in my magic. The math that I do, the way I've learned to tackle hard problems, shows up in the way I design routines, and it feeds back the other way as well.
That's great. And before we move on to speaking about One Summer Eats, is there any advice that you can give newer magicians and performers that are watching this when it comes to nerves? Because it's a big issue for so many magicians, especially newer into magic, the shaky hands, it can really affect people. Somebody who that you're living is standing up in front of people talking. And then obviously what you do as a hobby stroke semi-professionally is the same thing. You stand up in front of people and perform, and you've been in some very stressful situations, and we'll talk about that. But, you know, performing at places like 4F, very stressful, I can imagine. So how do you manage your nerves, and how do you, you know, is there a magic wand you can wave, or any advice that you can give?
I don't have a magic wand for this, but I do have some advice, or at least experience I can share. In fact, I have a lot of experience with nerves, and I've reflected on it quite a bit. So back when I used to sing and play guitar, and in college, I was in a cappella group, and I was always very, very, very nervous singing solo in front of people, which is weird since I made a point out of being in situations where I had to sing in front of people, but my voice would shake. My whole body was shaking. I had a pit in my stomach. And, you know, I think it was a psychological complex. I mean, I think somewhere deep down, I knew that I was not the greatest singer in the world. I mean, again, I can hold a tune, and I'm not bad. But when I was young, my parents used to tease me about my singing voice, and I think it gave me a complex. I mean, eventually they would compliment me and say, oh, we were wrong about it. You know, you're actually a good singer. But I think I never lost the complex, and it sort of haunted me. And I had a very difficult time ever relaxing when singing. And that's one of the reasons I realized that magic was a better hobby for me, because it's about confidence. It's about feeling like you know what you're doing. So when teaching, I mean, I know, okay, occasionally I don't know what I'm talking about, and then I'm nervous, right? But 95% of the time, I know what I'm talking about when I'm teaching. I've taught these classes a lot. When I give research talks, I travel around the world giving research talks, or used to before the pandemic. And I generally prepare, and I know what I'm doing. And it gives a confidence. And I'm just not nervous when I have that confidence. So magic is the same. When I started out, my first audition for our local magic club here in Atlanta, my hands were shaking. I did a matrix routine that involved some somewhat ballsy moves that actually now I wouldn't do that anymore. I have ways of finessing that where you don't have to do it, right? But it was something, and my hands were just shaking the whole time I was doing that routine. And so one thing I do is I'm just more confident now because I practice, and I've been in magic long enough, read enough, thought about it enough, that I'm more confident that, okay, I'm doing something interesting. I'm not the greatest magician in the world. I don't have the best chops in the world. But, you know, I know I can do certain things well. I know how to be in front of an audience and connect with people, be entertaining, be interesting. And so I just trust that feeling. But you have to learn to trust yourself, and you have to have the confidence, but it can't be fake confidence. You know, I try to give myself fake confidence while singing, but somewhere deep down, I was still not confident. And so it has to be genuine. So we try to fool other people as magicians in our tricks. But the hardest thing, I think, is to fool yourself if you really don't believe something and you're trying to convince yourself in front of an audience. Your body's going to give you away.
That's great. That's fantastic advice. It really is. Thank you, Matt. Now, you talked about Juan Samaritz earlier, and I know that you have spent a lot of time with Simon Aronson as well. I mean, I can't think of two better teachers when it comes to magic. So my question is, how did that come about? So you came back into magic at the age of 30. How did your connection begin with Simon Aronson? And also, how did you end up spending time in Spain with Juan Samaritz?
So I mean, each of those sort of have a different story. And the other person that now I you know, feel close to and who's been a real mentor is Joshua Jay. So I would say those are three of my favorite magicians, and all, I mean, very different people, but all great with Memdeck work in particular, card magic in general. And, you know, so in each case, it was just, again, it's sort of a confidence thing. I mean, I'm not afraid to reach out to people, even if they're famous, if I think I have something that's worth their time. I'm very careful about trying to not waste people's time. So, you know, I don't just go bug people trying to get their signature or trying to take a photo with them just because, you know, I want to. I mean, maybe it's not such a waste of time to take 5 seconds to take a photo with someone, but, you know, I'm very careful to not take a lot of people's time unless I feel like they're going to enjoy or get something out of talking to me as well. But I was a little brash when I first got started in magic and just contacted some of the people I was reading and learning, you know, through their books and videos. So I contacted Josh Jay, who's the friendliest person, always responds to emails, even if he doesn't know who you are. So but it took a long time to be at the point where I think he was getting as much out of talking to me as I have always gotten from talking to him. With Simon Aronson, similarly, I mean, he was very friendly. I visited Chicago and I just said, I'm going to be in town. You don't know me, but I'm a big fan of yours. Maybe we could meet for coffee or something. And he said, yes. And he invited me up to his apartment and we had coffee there for about an hour. And we actually didn't so much keep in touch immediately after that. I felt a little embarrassed afterwards, like he's not going to even remember who I am. But I ran into him and Ginny at a magic convention 2 years later, and he remembered me and we talked and we just kind of hit it off there and started sitting together, having dinner together, chatting, doing tricks, talking, and realized that we had similar, something in common. And importantly, he seemed to enjoy, and Ginny as well, spending time with me. So then they were in Atlanta 6 months after that performing. And my wife and I invited them over for brunch to our house, and we just had the best day. And my wife works at CNN. She gave them a tour behind the scenes of the CNN studios, and they had a great time with that. And so then we became close, and eventually I helped edit Simon's last book that he put out. And I did an interview with him that will come out someday, that about a year or two before he died, that I think he revealed a lot that he's never shared before in that. And so it's, again, just a matter of feeling like you have something to give as well as something to take. And then as long as I have that confidence, I'm not afraid to go up to famous people. Juan was a little bit different in the sense that he advertised a masterclass that he was running. You know, I paid for it. It wasn't like, hey, can I come over to your house and hang out? I thought it was a great deal. You know, we got to stay at his house and have 8 hours a day for 4 days in a row, just five of us and Juan Tamariz. And I would have paid a lot for that experience. And it was great. It's great.
That's fantastic.
And on that subject, and we'll talk about the Buena Vista Shuffle Club in a bit. But one of the things that struck me about it is it was all based around an imaginary session. Now, how important do you think it is for magicians that are getting into magic to find other magicians to bounce ideas off? Because in this day and age, there are a lot of magicians that are literally, they've come into magic through the internet and they've never actually even gone to a magic club or met another magician. And I'd like to know how important is it to find like-minded people to bounce ideas off and you know, meet up with regularly?
So for me, it's hugely important, but it's also important to get out and perform for non-magicians, right? So I really try to do both. Nowadays I'm not performing so much for non-magicians because I don't have a big Zoom-based repertoire. And I'm pretty busy with my job these days, which is more time consuming than it used to be, in fact. But I mean, having said that, I still love performing for real people. I try to get a lot of experience with that. But by itself, that can leave you with blinders. So I think both of those things on their own can leave you with blinders. That would be my advice, is well, definitely don't just perform over the internet and film yourself and put videos out without talking to real people or being in front of real people. I mean, I guess it works for some, but for me, that would be both unsatisfying and I wouldn't improve that way. So the ways that I get better are, first of all, just getting that experience being out in the real world, which I used to, before the pandemic, I was probably performing once or twice a month in some kind of gig, which for me is enough. I don't really have time for more than that. I don't need to make money off of it since I have a stable job. So it's just enough to keep me on my toes. And but I also get together, I do participate in a local magic club. We have a great club here in Atlanta, two great clubs, in fact. But I also have session partners and I go to conventions and, you know, hang out with really smart people who give me great advice. But in particular, I have a friend, Rich Aviles, who isn't well known to the whole magic community, but he's kind of an underground force. And he's really smart, gives really candid advice. And we met almost every weekend while I was writing the book and road testing. I mean, I'd done a lot of the routines for a while, but I was trying to perfect them, get it down in writing, and really make sure that the handlings were streamlined and that. And Rich just really helped me think everything out. We went through basically every routine and just talked out every detail of it. And that's just something you don't get performing in the real world. You know, people, you just won't know if there's a better way to do something. I mean, people will clap if you produce sponge bunnies, and nothing against sponge bunnies, right? They're amazing. There's all kinds of routines that are great. And even if you're a pretty lousy performer, some of those will get great reactions. That doesn't mean that you should just keep doing it like that forever just because it gets good reactions. That's not the goal. At least, well, maybe it is some people's goal. My goal is to be as good as I can be, and it's always get better. My goal is not to win a FISM trophy or to prove that I'm better than you just had Sean Farquhar on the show, right? I probably won't ever prove that, you know, I'm more accomplished than Sean, and I'm totally fine with that. Sean's amazing. I just want to be as good as I can be. And if I can learn from people like Sean, like Josh Jay, Simon Aronson, Juan Tamariz, Rich Aviles, I'll learn from anybody who's willing to give me candid advice, help me think about stuff. But then I also don't want to not do something just because they say, well, yeah, I don't know if that would fool magicians. If I see that it's a real worker trick that I can go out and do and people will love it and it's something original that I enjoy doing, I don't really care if it fools magicians or not. That's how I approach it.
Perfect. Perfect. Now, you, although you do a lot of magic, you're known as a operator of Memdeck. You know, Memdeck magic is something that you're very well known for. When did that come about? What made you decide? Because there's so many magicians that are afraid of learning the Memdeck. They just flat out refuse. I can't do that. I do the Memdeck. My 7-year-old son does the Memdeck. And my question is, so my question is, for all of the magicians watching this that don't do the Memdeck, please explain to them what they're missing out on. And can you offer any advice as to how to actually start learning it? And so that, you know, they can start doing the sort of routines that you know are really powerful that they're missing out on.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, so of course I love Memdeck magic. I think it's an amazing tool that is underutilized. And I do encourage anyone that's interested in card magic to give it a try. But there's all kinds of magic out there. It probably doesn't suit everybody's style. You know, if you're into really visual stage illusions, then you probably don't need to memorize a deck. But you know, but if you're into close-up card magic and mentalism, both of which I like a lot, it's an amazing tool. And it is difficult. I mean, I would say one thing, maybe I would say that's different from what some other folks say. A lot of people will say, oh, it's so easy to memorize a deck. You know, you can do it in 2 hours and then you have this for the rest of your life. Well, I don't buy it. It took me a lot longer than that. And the problem is, I mean, you can put anything into short-term memory pretty easily. The memdeck you need in long-term memory. You don't want to be out performing and suddenly forget what the stack number of the four spades is. And 2 hours one time is not going to cut it. So it's not that simple. I mean, having said that, it's also not nearly as difficult as a lot of things that magicians who like sleight of hand seem to be willing to put time into, right? Yeah, so, you know, people will spend a month or 6 months perfecting some really knacky move, and they won't think twice about putting the time into that. But for some reason, they're reluctant to memorize a deck, which is less effort for a much bigger payoff, in my opinion. You get a tool that you can use for the rest of your life for many, many different things, rather than just some quick visual moments with one particular move in a couple of routines. So anyway, that's how I look at it. Now, the way I memorized a deck, it took me a few days to a week to really get it into my medium to short-term memory. And then I had to drill the stack pretty frequently to keep it in long-term memory. At some point, I think it's, now it would be hard for me to forget that I learned the Aronson stack, but I think for any stack, it's the same. You know, so you do have to put some initial time into it. And it probably took me a month before I would go out and actually do anything for anyone and be confident I wouldn't forget the stack numbers in the heat of performance. And maybe that's drilling 10 to 20 minutes every other day for a month or something like that. That's not really that big of an investment for what I've gotten out of it, right? So it's not easy in the sense that if you're used to, you know, getting a payoff after 2 hours, I think that's just unrealistic. Even, you know, 6 hours or whatever people, there's some mythology about this. I think it takes longer to really get it down and it takes some steady drilling. But in fact, I find that enjoyable. So when I'm swimming, that's one of my hobbies that I have kept because it's for my health. I swim pretty regularly and, you know, I do laps for 30 to 45 minutes and I just run through my stack when I start swimming. And then I'll run through it backwards. And sometimes I'll run randomly through it. And you know, I'll do that a few times a week. That's all you need to keep it fresh.
That's great advice. Now, would you mind showing us a routine that involves memdeck? Because we do have a lot of newer magicians on this channel that might not have even seen a routine with a memdeck before. Would it be okay for you to perform something for us?
Sure. But let me just preface it by saying that I realized in thinking about what I might share with you here that most of the memdeck stuff I do is really not, does not translate well on video and without a spectator cutting cards, or it just doesn't work. So I will show you something. I don't know if this is, I wish I could demonstrate something else that is a little more blockbuster, but this is what I think I can do in this format. Okay. And it's really designed for two spectators. So you can either play the role of two spectators, Craig, or you can grab Ryland if he's around, or, you know, as you like.
He's in bed. He's so gutted because when I told him I was interviewing you, he was like, can I stay up and speak to him? I was like, sorry, dude, you got to get to bed. It's late here. he's so, sure. I'm not in his good books, put it that way.
All right. Well, that's a funny thing for me to hear. thank you. Anyway, so yes, I will show you something and you'll just play the role of two spectators, Craig. So,
that's fine.
Yeah. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to maybe on camera. Yeah, let me do it this way. I will just go like this and you'll just say stop whenever you like. Okay.
Okay. Stop.
Right there. Do you want me to go a little further, a little less?
No, I'm happy there.
Okay, so take a look at that. I'm not looking at the screen. Can you see the card?
Yeah, I can.
Okay. Of course, if I was looking at the screen, then I would know what card you're thinking of, but I Scout's Honor, I didn't look. This is explained in my book, and you can see that the method doesn't rely on using a Zoom screen to tell the spectator's card. Okay, so now for the second spectator, you'll pretend to be Ryland now.
Okay.
What I will do, we'll do this a little bit differently for you, Ryland. So I'm going to thumb through like this, and you'll just say stop whenever you like.
Stop.
Right there?
Yep.
Right, now you can look at either this card or this one, or this one, or this one, or this one, or this one. Just remember one of those cards. You got one?
Yes, I have.
Okay. For the magicians out there, no breaks. I can put the deck away now. Nothing, very clean. And now I'm going to read your mind. So I'll go to this other screen now because I don't need the cards anymore. So I want you to both, Craig and Ryland, send me the color of the card. It's difficult over the internet, but try to send me impressions of, just concentrate on the color. Okay, I'm definitely getting an impression of a red card. Which of you is thinking of a red card?
Craig is.
Craig is, okay, great. All right, now, very good. So Craig, you're doing great. Ryland, maybe you're a little sleepy. Why don't you focus just a little bit harder, this time on the suit. Okay, so try to project the suit to me. Very good, okay. So I'm getting a shape. It's a little bit unclear, but it's a curvy shape, like, I see a sharp corner.
Right.
Yeah, it's
right.
Like a diamond or a spade. It's a diamond or a spade. Which of you is sending me that?
Craig is.
Craig is again. Okay. So Craig, let me ask you a favor here. You're doing great, but you have a little bit of a dominant personality, and I think you're drowning your son's thoughts out here. So Craig, I want you to tone it down a little bit. Ryland, I want you to concentrate as much as possible and try to send me, whether it's a high card or a low card, okay? But Craig, you send it too. Just try not to overwhelm Ryland again. Okay, I'm getting an impression of a high card. Which of you is sending me that?
Both of us.
Ah, good job. Okay, so now I think we finally got it. Oh yeah, the impressions, they're coming in nice and clear here. Very, very clear. So Craig, I believe you were thinking of the Queen of Diamonds. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, very good. And Ryland, you didn't come in until the end there, but I believe that at the end, you very clearly started sending me a card, and the card you were sending me was the King of Clubs. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. That is brilliant. That is phenomenal. And that kind of it demonstrates your style of magic, which I do want to talk about in a bit, in that that is using a mem deck, but in a very different way to how you normally see one used. Really clever. Obviously, I've read your book, so I know the routine. And it's a really clever way that you're actually using a mem deck. I've never seen anything like that before. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant routine.
Thank you.
And I think the question on that is, you know, how would you go around creating something like that? Because obviously you are a very creative person. You can't write a book without being as good as you have without being creative. What creative process do you go through when you're actually creating your magic, especially something like that? I'm guessing there might be some, because obviously you've said that Simon Aronson was a mentor to you, and obviously I don't want to give anything away on the channel, but there's obviously some Simon Aronson concepts being used in there, not just the memorized side of things, but a few other concepts that Simon made famous. But where how would you go around creating routines? You know, if somebody's watching this and they want to be creative, they want to create their own magic, is there any advice you can give?
Yeah, well, again, I can talk about my own experiences and maybe that will be helpful for other people. So I think, you know, creativity, it's an elusive thing. I mean, sometimes we all have mental blocks and just can't really think of anything very interesting. And you just have to keep trying. So, you know, one common expression is that one common sentiment is that if you're not creating a lot of bad stuff, you're never going to create anything good, right? So, I mean, if you never come up with any bad tricks and don't try stuff that just flops, you're probably not being sufficiently creative and trying to think outside the box. So, you know, then you can ask, well, how do I know if something's good or not? And that's where the experience comes in, just like with calming your nerves. I mean, you just have to have enough experience to both know how spectators are likely to react to something, how, you know, what magicians will think of it, to know whether what you're doing is really new or if it's a well-known concept, to know if there's a better way out there that you're not taking advantage of. You have to have experience for all those things. But, you know, the creativity part is just not being afraid to fail and trying things out. So this was just an idea I had. It was actually in a correspondence with Simon Aronson. He sent me a manuscript that he hadn't published that he was working on and asked me for my feedback on it. And it was sort of similar to this, but different. I don't want to go into all the details. But, you know, there were some things I liked about Simon's routine that I wanted to take advantage of. And then there were some things I wasn't crazy about. But he had actually written some other stuff I had read in one of his earlier books that I thought that would actually be interesting with this kind of effect. And then I just started playing around with it. And I went through different handlings of this effect I just showed you. What I like about the handling that I just showed, it just comes with trying things out and again, experimenting. The handling I just did doesn't require a table. So I could do that in walk around. It automatically resets the deck. So I'm ready to go on with any other effects I want to do that might involve having some cards in certain orders. And that trick can sort of be done over Zoom as well, as you see. So it's pretty flexible. And that's from the real world side of me wanting to have an effect that's practical. So certain methods and certain plots, I just decide, yeah, I mean, in theory, that's good, but nobody's going to use that. This one I thought was a nice balance between something like I can use and other people could actually use in the real world. But also it has some, I think, a little bit of the methodology. It's not really new. Nothing, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to recreate. I mean, it's hard to be completely original. Everything in that trick borrows an ingredient from something, but I think I put them together in a new way. And the way that the questioning works. So for those of you out there that might or might not be convinced by this routine, I will say it works exactly like that every time. So you never get a no answer. When I'm saying, oh, I'm getting an impression of this, one of you or both will always say yes. So that was really the motivation for this, is that I don't like routines where you're fishing for information and you say, it's a red card, isn't it? And they say, no. And then you go, well, there's black cherries or whatever. I mean, you know, there's ways magicians try to handle this, but it's just not great. You can get away with it. Again, in the real, like people say, well, it plays. Well, yeah, I mean, there's lots of things that play. You can do, there's all sorts of things you can get away with and people will clap for, but it's not perfect. I mean, I try to get as close to the ideal effect as I can. And a real mentalist, whatever that would mean, wouldn't get things wrong unless it looked in the end like they were trying to get something. You know, it's okay to get things wrong because you're trying to make it not too perfect. If it's strategic and well thought out, it's fine. But, you know, if you're fishing and you miss, and that's the only reason you're doing it, it's even better to think of a different method that doesn't involve that. So that's how I started thinking about this routine.
That's very true. I've got one last question about Mendex before we move on. One thing that I hear a lot of people saying is, I'm not going to learn a Mendex because I'm a working magician and I don't want to be in a situation where my stack is ruined and I have to put it back together again. One thing that I've noticed about a lot of your routines is it's self-resetting. As soon as you've completed the routine, it's either reset the stack or it takes like seconds to reset the stack. And you've got routines in your book where you can actually take a deck that's, you know, like half stack, and you can actually stack half the deck or stack the, you know, restack the deck.
Right.
How important is it to you when you're creating magic with a mem deck to actually have that scenario play out where you can actually have the deck reset? Do you think that there are certain effects that warrant the destruction of a stack?
Yeah, it's important to me to have that reset for all the reasons you said. And I also do think there are some effects that, you know, you can close with, and you can, it's worth destroying a stack for. They don't even have to be closers. I use certain effects that do destroy the stack in the middle of a set sometimes. And then we'll just do some routines with a shuffled deck. And then if I want to end with another mem deck piece, I will either switch decks at some point, which is pretty easy to do. If you're, you know, if you think about it, you're routining. And also, as you said, I have some routines that restack the deck in the course of doing another effect, and others have come up with ideas like that too. So there's a lot of options. I just don't think people should be afraid of ruining a stack. I mean, you know, it takes me, I don't know, just over 2 minutes maybe to stack the deck. I mean, in private, in front of people, it's, if you don't want them to know what you're doing, then that's much harder. But so, you know, I like to have an extra mem deck on me anyway, whenever I'm performing mem deck stuff, both so I can ring in. I mean, I'd like to, ideally I start with a shuffled deck, or I do something with a mem deck, then allow it to be shuffled on purpose. Even if the routine resets the trick, I'll sometimes just hand the spectators, if it looks like they want to shuffle or they're suspicious about whether the cards are in an order, just say, here, check it out, you know, shuffle the deck. We just go into something else. And then I've got another mem deck in my pocket, and I'll close with the routine using that if the situation warrants. And it's also just to get out of trouble. You know, I have a spare deck in case, like, I've been on stage in front of 100 people doing a mem deck routine and the volunteer just didn't follow my instructions. In fact, I had one funny experience about 2 years ago, maybe, where a woman didn't speak English very well. She was from France and she didn't know the words I was using. And so she didn't understand what I was saying. And I had a blindfold on in this routine. And so she just shuffled the deck when I asked her to cut it. And I could tell from the audience gasps, you know, that something had happened. And I figured out that I was in trouble, but I wasn't in trouble because I had another mem deck in my pocket. And I didn't do a very elegant deck switch, but I mean, it's an emergency. So I got the other deck in. And the funny thing about that, it's slightly off topic, but then I still had an issue because the closing, this was my card college routine, which is the first trick in the book, which I'd love to show you, but it really doesn't work in this context over video camera. But anyway, the climax of that routine is I'm calling out cards with a blindfold on that I literally haven't touched since the spectator shuffled the deck herself. Like, even in the actual routine, there is a point at which I tell her to shuffle the deck. It's just she did it too early. But in the routine, the spectator shuffles, I never touch the cards again, but they cut off some cards, put them in the box, and I can tell exactly which cards are in the box. And I call them off, but she didn't know the names of the cards in English. But luckily I spent some time living in France and I went to a bunch of magic shows when I was there. And I do know the names of cards in French. So I called them out in French. And I got like the biggest applause, you know, I've gotten for almost any show before. And a lot of people thought we set that up, that whole thing. And it was all like a big fake magician in trouble. It wasn't, it was just thinking on my feet.
But you know what? I think that's a really important skill for a magician to have. You've got to be able to, yeah, you can script things to the nth degree, but you have to be able to go in a different direction because you can never manage everything. You never know what's going to happen.
And that's why you script things in advance, in fact, is so that you're able to think. Because if you're worried about what you're going to say and your brain is occupied with your words because you haven't practiced them, it's very difficult to make those adjustments. If you know the script and you know the routine well, Then when it starts to go off the rails, well, then now you do have to think, but at least you don't have to occupy yourself with the scripting or the handling. You know those things.
Absolutely. Now we've talked about the book an awful lot. We've alluded to the book an awful lot. I'd like to talk to you about it specifically in a couple of different ways. First of all, where did you come up with the concept of how the book was written? And for those people that haven't read Matt's book, it's I read a lot of magic books, and unfortunately, some of them are quite dull. It's great magic, but it's a real... I've fallen asleep reading some magic books, desperately trying to learn a routine, and it's sending me to sleep. But your book is great. It's almost based around this fake group of friends, and each routine that you do, the routine is described, but then afterwards you cut to this group of people who are discussing the routine, and then each one of them's talking about how they would make it better, and each one of them's got personalities. By the time I've finished the book, I felt I know those guys better than I knew you, and it was such an interesting concept. Where did that all come from?
Yeah, thanks. Glad that resonated with you. I have gotten a lot of good feedback about that aspect of the book. And yeah, I'll tell you how that came about. It started with the thing you're saying, which is that I love magic books, but a lot of them I find really boring, to be honest. I often go to sleep at night, you know, go to bed with a magic book. And sometimes it's because I know it's going to put me to sleep. And I occasionally have a hard time getting to sleep. And so I'll say, oh, this is a pretty dull book, but, you know, I want to learn something in it. And so I really, of course, there are counterexamples to that. There's some really lively, great writers. But by and large, I find it a bit dull when people just describe it. A trick. Sometimes you don't even know what the effect is, right? They just start going into the method and describing the handling and how to set up the deck, and you don't really even know yet what the trick is and whether you're interested. So I had some criteria when I sat down to write a book. One was I really wanted it to be interesting. I wanted people to enjoy reading it and not just hopefully enjoy the magic. I, of course, also wanted the magic to be strong. I wouldn't have written a book unless I felt like I had enough material to put in a book. But, in a way it was hedging. I thought, well, okay, if someone doesn't like the tricks, they might still enjoy reading it. But that wasn't the main thing. It was mostly, I just wanted to write the kind of book that I would want to read. So I wanted something interesting. But then, okay, how do you make it interesting? What can you do different? And, to be honest, I wanted to stand out a bit. I'm not a household. I appreciate that you've been plugging my books and reviewing my products well. So thank you very much. And to others that have said kind things about it, but, still not famous. And that's fine with me. As I said, I don't need to win any trophies or be world famous. I do want to be respected in the magic community, and I want people to enjoy what I do. So I just wanted to put out a good product I want to put out something people would like and find interesting, not to be famous, but just, why else would we put hard work into something unless we're going to be proud of it? So I spent a lot of time thinking about different ways I could make it stand out, be unusual, get it noticed so that people would actually take the time to read the thing I put all this work into. And as with the other creative process I was describing, I just went through a lot of ideas. I had a lot of bad ideas for the structure of the book. Some of them I tried and it didn't work. I was inspired in part by the Books of Wonder, which I hope that viewers and readers know. If not, go check out the Books of Wonder. Tommy Wonder's amazing magician, and Stephen Minch did an incredible job writing the book. And there's amazing essays scattered throughout among really good tricks as well. So the tricks are very well explained. Everything's crystal clear. But in between, you hear Tommy's thoughts about all kinds of things. Some of the kinds of theory we're talking about. I mean, he goes into everything and just has brilliant things to say. And that was sort of the problem when I tried to do that. I mean, I'm not Tommy Wonder. I don't have 30 some years of professional performing experience and this brilliant philosophy of misdirection and that, so I realized when I tried to write essays like that and intersperse them with the tricks, it just wasn't really working. You know, I didn't feel, it's like that feeling I talked about with singing earlier, where I somewhere deep inside, I know that this isn't, it's just not right. And, you know, made me feel nervous. So I just knew that that wasn't working. So I threw out some of the essays I'd written. A couple of them were probably good and I could publish somewhere, but wasn't working in the context of a book. So I just tried other things. And then I came up with the idea to have a fictional group of magicians. Maybe subconsciously, I don't think it was consciously, I might've been influenced by Josh Jay wrote a book called Session that involves him, you know, interviewing another magician and writing the dialogue of that. But one thing, Josh is my really good friend and I don't wanna criticize anything, but one thing I found difficult reading that book, you know, which I read a long time ago, was that you don't get the descriptions of the tricks as much, because it's all written in this dialogue format. The whole book is written like a dialogue. And so you don't really know where the tricks begin, where they end, where the explanation is, where the credits are. I found it actually, I do like traditional books in that way too. You know, I like the structure of knowing where to look later on to find the setup or the credits. So I wanted to blend those structures. And so I came up with the idea of these sessions, because I, as I said earlier, I love sessioning. I love, you know, bouncing ideas off other magicians. And I've done it enough that I could write these kind of dialogues without too much work, because I could just hear other people, you know, people like Simon Aronson or Rich or others telling me, like, that idea sucks. Or, you know, why are you doing it that way? Like, why are you showing the faces of the cards when blah, blah, blah. I can just hear those voices in my head now from spending enough time with magicians. And so, you know, you write what you know to a large extent. So I just tried to write with clear voices. And I imagine, I'm not going to give away, I mean, in my mind, there were certain correlations between certain people I've sessioned with and certain characters. I exaggerated it a lot and took artistic license. But, you know, it's like any novelist or other writer would have certain models in mind and they start to know the characters. So I treated the book that way. And yeah, in the end, I think my first draft wasn't great. I got a lot of criticism from Simon Aronson, who was always bluntly honest with me about everything. And he would say, like, what things for him didn't work. Other people told me they didn't like certain dialogues I'd written. So I rewrote them and I kept rewriting. So that's the other dirty secret to writing or to performing magic, creating tricks. You just have to be willing to edit a lot. You have to rewrite. You have to rewrite your scripts. You have to refine your handling. When you're writing a book, you just have to keep rewriting and show it to people, get honest feedback, take it into consideration and be willing to just chuck it. A few tricks never made the book. They didn't make the cut because I just realized after hearing some criticisms that I hadn't thought about it enough. There were just routines where I was like, yeah, you know, you're right. I mean, I haven't nailed this one yet. And so maybe in the next book, it will be worked out, but I didn't want to put in anything that I didn't have confidence in.
And you could tell that there was no filler in that book. It was amazing. And for anybody who's got aspirations of writing their own book, how did you go around publishing it? Because I know it went through Murphy's. Did you self-publish or did you go through a magic dealer?
I self-published. That was actually partly on the advice of Simon again, who was really my, I don't know, business manager during the process of writing a book. I mean, he's written my favorite magic books of all time are probably Simon's. And he self-published all of his books. And I did explore options of getting it going through a magic publisher, you know, but either because they weren't interested because they didn't know who I was or because that I wasn't apparently seeing eye to eye with them. I just decided, you know what, I'm going to do it on my own time schedule. I'd also, when I released some earlier products, I had some issues with the timing where things would take a lot longer than I wanted and it was totally out of my control. And I don't know that I'm a control freak, but I do get nervous when things are out of my control and they start to take a lot longer than they should. So I thought I'm gonna keep as much under my control as I can. And it was great. I did work, you know, so I hired a professional designer, Phil Schaff from the UK. I don't know if you know Phil, but he's amazing.
He's great. Yeah, I do know.
And, you know, so I wasn't going to try to do the layout I took the photos myself with my daughter. But I wasn't going to try to get the layout looking right. And the font I had, you know, in my draft was not great. I knew it needed a snazzier look, but I'm not good with those things. So I hired Phil to do all of that. He did an amazing job. So that was money very well spent. You know, that's not something you want to skimp on. Originally I looked into some self-publishers that are really cheap online that, and, you know, they do actually like, there's offset printing, which is what I went with, that uses the traditional, method of printing that's been around for a long time. And then there's sort of modern, essentially like laser printers, or I forget what it's called, but, you know, it's cheaper, but I think it doesn't look as good. And I got a sample, you know, make sure you got a sample from anyone you're going to publish a book with. So I got a book that they published, not even a magic book, but I looked at it. The binding wasn't great. It started to, you know, just after a couple of days, the pages started to separate a bit and it wouldn't lay flat on the table. And I didn't like the sheen on the cover. I mean, you know, you just have to. So I spent money with a good publisher. I ended up going with Sheridan Books, which is a very reputable publisher, which is who Simon published his books with. And it cost a bit more, but again, totally worth it. But then the advantage of publishing yourself is you get to, if you sell it yourself, you get to keep 100% of the profits instead of sharing 60% with Murphy's, or, you know, I mean, I don't know if everyone gets the same deal, but that is the deal that I got. I did distribute most of the books. I've distributed through Murphy's Magic, which is a wholesaler. And yeah, I mean, they, I don't make nearly as much when I sell the book through Murphy's, but, you know, I also have a full-time job and I have three kids. And so going to the post office every day and packing up my own books is not really appealing. So I did start out that way for a few weeks. I sold it myself and I still sell through my website because now it's slowed down. But there was a point where I was selling a lot of books regularly and I just didn't have the time to do that. Also promoting the book, that's the real thing that's hard if you do it yourself. If you don't have a big mailing list, I mean, how are you going to get the word out, right? So I don't have a big mailing list. So what I did is I also worked out, well, I got a couple of friends who believed in me to spread the word, which was great. And there were some internet sites, you know, Magic Cafe and such, where people said good things, not unsolicited by me. But in addition, Vanishing Ink put out a blurb in their one of their weekly newsletters about the book. And they had exclusive rights to the book for the first, I forget, couple of weeks that it was out. And, you know, so in exchange, they got some things out of that deal, but I got the publicity from it. And so I think you have to tap into some existing databases if you want people to know about your work. And but that doesn't mean you have to publish it with someone else. You can self-publish and still get your name out there.
That's great. And before we move on, would you be able to show us one more routine at the book? I'm not going to handcuff you and tell you it has to be a Memdeck routine.
Don't right. worry about
that. Because I know there's a lot of other stuff in the book as well, but would you be able to perform one more thing?
Yeah, sure. Would you like to see a card trick or a coin trick? I mean, I'm mostly a card guy, but you know, there's a couple coin tricks.
See, in I love your card material, but I don't know if you know this. I'm a coin guy. I love coins.
I do know that, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, I want to see the coin trick, if that's okay. Or both.
Yeah, let's do that. And then later we can do one more card thing. Okay, so never done this one on Zoom, so we'll see if it works or not on the camera, but hopefully it will. So Craig, being a coin guy, I am quite sure that you are familiar with, you're a card and a coin guy. So I'm sure you're familiar with three card Monty, but I've actually invented a game that I call three coin Monty, which is not as well known. But would you like to see it?
I would. I'd love to see it.
Great. So this is the way that three coin Monty works. It's like three card Monty. Can you see these coins? Fairly well.
Right. Yeah. really well.
Okay, good. So these are Kennedy half dollars. And what we're going to do, Craig, is just mark one of these with an X. Which one would you like me to mark?
The middle one.
The middle one. Okay, great. So I'm going to put a big X in Kennedy's head there. No grassy knoll jokes, please. too soon. All right. So hopefully you can see the X on Kennedy's head there. And now we're going to do a Monty game. So your goal is to try to follow the X, okay?
Okay.
All right. Where's the X, Craig?
It's on your right, my left.
This one right here.
That one there.
Very good. Excellent. You got it. Would you like to bet money on it now?
I definitely would.
Okay. Well, someday we'll meet up in person and you can buy me a beer if you lose this bet. I wouldn't take more from you because it's a scam. You'll see. So you're trying to follow the X in the middle there, right?
Yep.
Okay. Where is it, Craig?
It's on the right. My right, your left.
This one here.
Yeah, that one there.
Yeah, that's what everybody says, but it's not there. it's not over there either. It's right here in the middle. But that's it's natural. It's a scam. Everybody falls for that. And the problem is that there's three coins here. I don't use a lot of stock lines, but I like this one. There's three coins here. You only have two eyes. It's really not a fair game. So I'm going to put one of the coins back. We'll take one of the ones that does not have an X on it. Okay. And we're just going to play two coin money now. Okay. So you can see this is the one with the X, this one, no X. And I'm going to do this as clearly as I can. So you can see the X is over here.
Yep.
I want to do this as clearly as possible. So no X, X. Now watch, Craig. I'm going to switch my hands and switch them back one more time. Where's the X?
My left, your right.
This one right here.
Yes.
Would you be willing to bet money on that?
Maybe.
Or at least a beer.
A beer. We'll go for a beer.
Oh, Craig, I'm so sorry because that one does not have an X. You lose, but it was a scam. I told you at the very beginning you should not play this game because this coin also does not have an X on it. The X coin was actually right over here in the coin purse.
That's great. I love that.
So that's why you should never play three coin Monty.
That was really great.
Thanks. You know, in person, it's fun because the spectator can actually dump the coin out themselves at the end of that routine. It's a very surprising moment.
I love that. I love that kicker at the end. It's really great. Now, where I want to put at the bottom of the screen right now, because we've been talking about your book, where can people go and buy it yourself if they want a signed copy and they want to get it directly from you? Is there a website address that they can go to?
There is, yeah. So it's www.mattbakermagic.com. That's my website. And if you go there, I do have the book for sale right now, in fact, on my website. So it's 20% off the usual price. And for until I decide to change it back. This is what the book looks like. So as I said, I tried to really have it, well done. I didn't skimp on the printing. So I was really pleased with how great a job Phil did with the layout. And, it's just, and I love physical books. You know, eBooks are great. I like to read on my books on my iPad and I like to watch videos too. But for me, there's something about a physical book that just has no substitute. And I love actual magic books I can go to sleep with at night, whether or not they're boring, and just be able to hold in my hand. So I think it's just a nice physical book, and a lot of magicians like the material in it too.
Oh no, it's amazing. And we've reviewed a lot of your stuff on the show. We've reviewed that. We also looked at your which I do all the time, and for some reason I always struggle to remember the name of it.
The Misfit deck.
The Misfit deck. I love that because it allowed me to take my cocky son and just blow him away, and I still haven't told him how that works. It's such it's another example of very clever thinking. I remember when I saw the trailer for that, I was just stumped completely. I was just like, that can't happen. That just doesn't make sense. so many different principles that you've kind of tied together there, and it's really nice.
Yeah, thank you. And that one, I guess it's still for sale through Card Shark and Vanishing Ink and Penguin. I have a few copies of that left, but not, I just have a few of those on my own. So I can sell that front through my website too, but my stock is low. Anyway, but yeah, that trick was my first product physical product that I put out. And yeah, that was where I kind of learned a bit about marketing, about some of the challenges and about how things can take a lot longer than you want. I mean, put it out through Card Shark, which had a fire in their warehouse that, you know, put them out of business for quite a while until luckily, you know, Christian came back, but that delayed things quite a while, and understandably, but, you know, it was frustrating to not have the control. So I decided with the book, everything would be under my control. But yeah, the routine itself, for Misfit Deck, it's a fun thing I've been doing for a long time. And yeah, it's just, again, trying to think differently about what you can do with certain principles and props that a lot of magicians are familiar with, but I employ it in a different way.
Can I ask you a completely different question?
Absolutely.
Thank you. You have talked about how that you have a job and you spend time, and you spend time performing magic, but you've written the book and you're practicing and creating, but you also have a family, you have a wife, you have children. How do you juggle all of that? Because that's a question I actually get on the channel a lot. I do these Q&A sessions, and every week I'll have the question, I just got into magic, but I have a family and I have a job and I don't feel like I've got the time to get good at it, and I want to get good at magic. And you seem to be the perfect person to be able to answer that, because you have so much going on, and you've talked about how you travel the world lecturing, and how do you do it all?
Well, my wife would tell you that I'm the wrong person to answer this question, because she would say I don't manage my time very well. I'd probably agree with it, but you know, I'm very passionate about a lot of things, and I really enjoy what I do. So when you enjoy what you do, you can make time for everything until you can't. And then you have to drop, you know, you have to give things up. You have to be willing to give things up. So like I said, I used to have a lot of hobbies. I was into trivia and music and writing poetry and doing magic. And I used to juggle a bit, and I don't know, a lot of things. I was in plays when I was younger, you know, some theater productions and all kinds of things, playing sports. But yeah, I mean, it's too much. When I became a grown-up and had real responsibilities, I couldn't keep doing all that. I'm still doing more than I should, but I can't give the magic up. It's just such a part of who I am, and I enjoy it so much. So I just make time for it. But I think maybe the advice I can give is that if you're in my position where you have another job and you have a family. And my job's quite busy. It keeps me extremely busy. There's many different facets to that too. I'm also an associate dean at Georgia Tech, in addition to being a professor. So I have a lot of administrative responsibilities. So, I mean, the thing is that my advice would be, don't be in a rush with the magic, you know, to do things quickly. So there's just a lot of times when I don't have much time for magic. You know, I'll sometimes go weeks without really having much time to practice, or without having time to learn any new routines. And sometimes I have friends that are getting together, or, you know, and I don't have time. But it's okay, because then things free up later. I mean, as an academic, my summers are usually less busy and I get winter breaks off. And so I have some free time that others don't have. And sometimes on weekends, I mean, usually weekends these days are busy with my kids, but I mean, occasionally, you know, I'll get out for a little bit and just have some time to myself, and I'll purposely not do work and just play around with cards and try to come up with a new idea. But you know, I don't rush it. Like if I had deadlines, it would be really tough. If I said I have to create two new tricks or learn this new trick by this date, then it would become very stressful for me. So I also don't let money, you know, get in the way of that. If I felt like, oh, I have to do a certain number of gigs every month or every year in order to add this much income to make it worthwhile, it would be very stressful for me, because I don't really advertise. I have a website, and you know, it's just word of mouth, and if people happen to Google it or whatever, But I don't go out and aggressively try to, you know, recruit clients. I just don't have time, and it would be stressful for me to then have to deliver on that. So I take the gigs that I want to do. If I'm too busy, I just say no, and I refer one of my many, you know, good magician friends in the area, and I'll give the gig, you know, refer it to them. When the pandemic started, I was really busy with work because the transition to online teaching and online everything was quite busy as an associate dean, as you can imagine, and I was teaching and had never taught online. So I had no time for magic back in March and April. And, you know, I didn't even want to make any money off magic at that time. So at that time, all the proceeds from my book, I donated to other magicians who were out of work, you know, when COVID first hit. And I had a special going where I would say, if you agree to donate the cost of the book to another magician that you can designate, you know, I'll ship you the book for free. Just because it's not, yeah, I don't need it to be able to eat and feed my family. And so that way it keeps it fun for me. And that way it's not stressful. You know, if it becomes a major stressor in your life, you either need to make it a job or you're taking it, you know, too seriously. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I think that, I do take magic very seriously, right? So it's not that I don't take it seriously. I want to get better. I want to be good. I want to innovate. I want to do something worthwhile and impactful, but I'm not on a timeline. I'm still relatively young and I've got a lot of time to do things. So I don't need to create any new tricks by next month. Right now, the only obligation I have is I'm writing a monthly column for Vanishing Ink on mathematical card magic on their blog. And I'm trying to stick, I mean, nothing would happen to me if I skipped a month, but trying to keep my discipline and write one column a month.
Okay. Here's a question. And I alluded to this at the very, very beginning, but I'd like to circle back to it now. Yeah. Can I talk to you about 4F? Because obviously you've been there three times performing, which is a massive honor, a huge honor. Can you talk about, if there's people watching this, how they would go about maybe trying to get an invitation to 4F, what it is for people that don't know, and how it came about with you?
Sure. So 4F is sort of the premier close-up magic convention in the world and gets an amazing group of magicians that attend. It's an invitation-only thing and the attendance is limited. I don't know how, I mean, it was canceled this year for the first time in about 50 years. You know, in general, it runs every year in April. And I love it because of the sessioning and because you see things that you don't see anywhere else. A lot of Asian magicians come. So from Japan, from South Korea. And you see these acts that just don't come through town, right? Your local magic club, it doesn't typically get the latest performer from Japan or South Korea or China who's doing this really cutting edge stuff. And often it's like they're practicing for FISM and they're, you know, getting it in front of other magicians to iron stuff out and get ideas. And so the shows are really cool because of that. The sessioning's just like fantastic. You know, you just sit down with these people that you just like have heard about as legend and then they're just right there hanging out with you. I mean, how you get in is you have to audition basically. So you have to have two sponsors that will write a letter of support for you. My sponsors were Simon Aronson and Dan Garrett. And then you have to send in a video, like an audition video of you performing something. And then it's up to Obi O'Brien, who runs the convention. I mean, he calls all the shots. So, you know, I don't know how he makes decisions and I don't know how many people don't get in versus do, but Obi keeps that all kind of to himself and he runs it a little bit like, you know, dictatorship, but benevolent dictatorship. He's a good guy and he puts on a really good convention. So people tolerate the fact that he makes all the decisions. So Obi used to be a math teacher in his, you know, former life. So I think I had an advantage there. He liked my profile. So maybe that's how I got in, and maybe a letter from Simon Aronson didn't hurt either. But anyway, so when once you get in, you have to perform the first three times you go. And so that is that's a rule. And it's, again, to sort of keep out the people that aren't serious, because I mean, if you're willing to get up there in front of those magicians and perform, you know, you have to have a little nerve and have some confidence and hopefully some good material, because otherwise you're in for a rough time. So in the front row, they put all the former guests of honor at 4F, because every year there's a new guest of honor who has like the last night to themselves. And they sit in the front row, they have sort of reserved seats. So, you know, I'm performing there for the first time at 4F with the front row is Sean Farquhar and Boris Wild and Pitt Hartling was the guest of honor one year. And, you know, I mean, I don't want to just sit here and name drop, but, you know, really good magicians that I've looked up to for a long time. And they're just sitting right in front of me, staring at me with a whole bunch of other, you know, 200 or 300 other magicians. And I've got to do something that's going to impress them and make a mark. So yeah, I did what I had to do. And I went 3 years in a row and performed. And the second time I was pretty nervous for whatever reason. And I messed up something and had to start over, but then it went fine. But you know, it wasn't ideal. But again, like we said, you just have to be able to roll with that, right? People actually complimented me afterwards. They were like, it was great the way you handled it. You know, a lot of people would have just panicked and not known what to do. I think it was, again, actually having another Memdeck in my pocket that saved me there. I just started over and I had messed up a setup, but I had a backup plan. So it was fine. And then the third and final time that the last time I performed, I thought it went really well. I got a lot of compliments afterward and, you know, just felt more confident from having done it a couple times. I was like, you know, I can do this. I even messed up last time and I was still okay afterward. And so I just went in with more confidence, fewer nerves, and finally nailed it. So yeah, that's my experience with that.
Great. Well, I suppose the question that I've got to ask you now is, what's next? What's on the bucket list? This is a question that I've asked pretty much everybody, and I'd like to know the same from you. I mean, you mentioned jokingly, but I'm hoping seriously, a second book. You've also said that you're very busy at the moment and that you've got a lot going on with your day job. You know, you've accomplished so much. Like you say, you've got many, many years left. You've accomplished so much. What's next? What are you planning on doing magically?
Yeah. Well, I do have, I have so much room to grow still, right? So that's one advantage of starting relatively late. I mean, I started when I was a kid, as I said, but I really only got serious in my 30s. I'm in my 40s now. I won't be more specific than that. But so, you know, I've got a lot of room to grow. There's many skills I wish I had that I don't have. So part of it is just, you know I've got a list of things I'd like to master, work on, plots I'd like to explore, but I don't have a timeline for it exactly, because again, I don't want to stress myself out too much. So I do hope I write another book someday. It was a really satisfying experience. I'm already working on material for a second book, but I don't know what the timeline would be. I don't know if it'll be 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. It's impossible to say. It's not going to be right away just because of how busy it is. And it takes a long time to come up with new material, road test it, be confident in it, and then write it all up. I actually wrote the book during a sabbatical from Georgia Tech, which, you know, I only get every once in a blue moon. So maybe the next sabbatical. But as far as other things besides writing a book, right before the pandemic hit, I was starting to develop a parlor show. I mean, I have a show I can do. I'm sort of interchangeable routines that I've been throwing in and trying stuff out, but I never really settled on a actual show that I do multiple times and really refine. You know, I like to, as an amateur who's not doing this for a living, it's just more fun for me to try out new stuff all the time. But, you know, there's definitely a value, of course, in really refining one show. So I was starting to put together a show that I would really work on that had more continuity to it rather than being a bunch of tricks. But, you know, now I don't know, I sort of lost my motivation because I don't know when the next time is I'm going to even be in an environment where I can try anything like that out. So right as I was getting focused on Parlor Style, now sort of like close up magic, card magic is in fashion again, because that's the kind of stuff you can do on camera. And I was also trying to get more, I'm trying to do more stuff that doesn't use a stack, because although for me, it's a wonderful tool. And I think it is very practical. People that think that it's a pain to carry a stack, I think that that's just over worrying. But on the other hand, of course, there's many situations where either you lose your stack, or you don't have a stack deck to begin with, or you want to borrow a deck, or any number of things. And you know, I know a lot of impromptu card tricks, but haven't actually invented nearly as many as I've invented stacked or gimmick tricks. So I'd like to develop more of my own repertoire with that, and that's a goal of mine. But again, right now I'm making some progress on that, but it's slow. And that's okay.
Yeah, like you say, you shouldn't have to put a time frame on stuff. You know, you create in your own time, which is perfect. Before we wrap this whole thing up, earlier on when you did the coin trick, you said maybe we'll do a card trick later on. Now okay. Is later on. Would you be okay showing one last thing, Matt? Would that be all right?
Yeah, sure. Be happy to. And in fact, I was just thinking about impromptu magic, so I'll show you a trick from my book that uses a shuffle deck. So, all right, yeah. So this can be a shuffled deck of cards. It is a shuffled deck of cards, regular bar deck, if you like. And Craig, you know, there's a lot of things that magicians have learned from gamblers, and vice versa, in fact. But magicians, we owe a lot of debt to gamblers, con men, scam artists, because they developed many techniques that were motivated by winning money that we now benefit from. And one of the techniques that was pioneered by gamblers that magicians really can benefit from is something called shuffle tracking, which is the ability to keep track of cards in a shuffled deck while it's being shuffled and cut and all of that. And so I'm going to demonstrate for you shuffle tracking. Let's try it with, I'll have you name a card, and then I'll mix the cards up and I'll try to keep track of the card that you name. So go ahead, name a card.
Seven of Hearts.
Seven of Hearts. All right, I'm going to show you that we do have one and only one Seven of Hearts in this deck, and that the deck is shuffled. So can you see this on the screen here?
Yeah, I can see it fine.
Okay. So there's the Seven of Hearts, and we'll make sure that there's only one of them, because this would be kind of stupid if I had a deck with lots and lots of Seven of Hearts. But you see that there are no other, there's a Seven of Diamonds, Seven of Spades, but no other Seven of Hearts. So we'll take out the Seven of Hearts and lose it somewhere in the middle of the deck here. All right. Yeah. And now I'm going to shuffle the deck up and try to keep track while I'm doing it of exactly where that card is. And if you were here, I would let you cut and complete the cut. I'll have to do it myself since you're in a different continent right now. But despite all that, what hopefully appears to be very fair shuffling and cutting, I was keeping track exactly of where that Seven of Hearts was the entire time. So Craig, I believe it was right here. If I'm not mistaken, that ought to be the Seven of Hearts. But I'll tell you what, people find that impressive, and you know, hopefully it looks impressive. It's very easy to do. In fact, I'm going to teach you how to do this right now. You just have to trust your subconscious. That's what the gamblers discovered, is that human beings just have an innate capability to do much more than, you know, we give ourselves credit for. It's just that we sometimes think we can't do it because we overthink things. So the one thing I want you to do, Craig, is don't overthink this. You know, if you actually actively try to keep track of it, you're not going to succeed. But just use your subconscious, okay? So relax. I'm going to give the cards another shuffle like we did before. And once again, I'll give it a few cuts. Again, if you were here or another spectator, I would let them give the cards a cut. And now, Craig, probably consciously, you don't know, but I believe in you. So what I'm going to do is ask you to say stop as I riffle through the cards, okay?
Stop.
Right there?
Mm-hmm.
Craig, you stop me right at this card. Very well done, my friend, the Seven of Hearts. But I'll tell you what, so you can see anybody can do that without even a lot of practice. You just have to trust yourself. I'm not going to claim that everything the gamblers do is easy, though. There are actually some pretty difficult things they do. And, you know, in a game of poker, I mean, if you could keep track of the Seven of Hearts only, that wouldn't actually be all that useful, right? You want a skill that's useful in a game of poker, you might want to keep track of more than one card at the same time. And that's much, much more difficult. And that does take a lot of practice. Luckily, I've practiced it, and I've been doing this the entire time, in fact. So not only, Craig, have I been keeping track of the Seven of Hearts, which you were the one that named the Seven of Hearts, correct?
Yeah.
So I decided to keep track of not just the Seven of Hearts that you named, but also a few other cards, the Seven of Diamonds, the Seven of Clubs, and the Seven of Spades.
That is brilliant. That is absolutely brilliant, Matt. Love that.
Thank you.
That's
called subconscious shuffle tracking, and that's taught in the book.
Well, one last question for you, actually.
Sure.
On the subject of watching you perform, obviously we've got to see some of your creations live here. Sometimes people like to see a magician actually perform the routines, you know, visual learners and so on and so forth. I know that you've done a Penguin Magic special and also an At the Table special.
Yeah.
Which one would you recommend if somebody wanted to watch you work, so to speak? I imagine you would recommend both of them, but is it the same material on both of them? Is it different material on both of them?
No, so it's totally different material. And, you know, I did that on purpose. I mean, I know that some people would have no problem going out and doing the same thing on two different platforms. But to me, again, just because I like to challenge myself, and I don't know, it didn't seem right to just do the same stuff and maybe one new thing to make people buy the new product, but you know, there's a lot of overlap. So it's actually, I think there's no overlap at all. Maybe there's one trick that I do in both, but or maybe with an improvement, I can't actually remember, but it's essentially completely different. And so it depends what kind of, you know, material you're interested in and what you want to see. I mean, the At the Table lecture, of course, is a lot cheaper than the Penguin Live Act is. So if you want the best, the cheapest thing, probably At the Table is better in that way. But the Live Act was really nice because I do a whole show in front of a live audience, you know, 45-minute show. And then sit down with Dan Harlan, and I went through the entire act and the thinking behind it. And, and he's great as, like you, he asks really good questions and he's knowledgeable and engaged. And so I think we had a great on-camera discussion and, getting to see me perform what I do in front of a live audience in the context of a show, I think has a lot of advantages too. And I do some bigger routines there. I do there's a parlor mentalism routine. In fact, there's two of them in that set, which play pretty big and certainly can't be done in a close-up environment. One is called Clue, based on the game of Clue. And I have people come up as the suspects in a murder mystery, and they put on name tags that say Miss Scarlet and things like that. And they each choose a murder weapon, and it's a lot of fun. And so I do that, routine in the show. And that's the kind of thing. So of course, on the At the Table close-up lecture, you're not going to see the close-up lectures, more kind of card magic and memdeck stuff. So they're totally different. If you like my stuff, you should get both. But of course, I mean, I don't really make huge profits off those. So I have no motivation other than saying, if you like my material, that's another way to learn it. All of that stuff, I think, is in the book. I didn't teach any routines in the videos that aren't also in the book. But as you say, people are visual learners and they like to see how things look in real life. And that's great. I'm a visual learner too, even though I love books. So I think all those resources are valuable, and I tried to make them all valuable so that if you do spend your hard-earned money on any of these things, I think you will see value for it. I haven't had anyone say, oh, you just did that to put it out there to have another product and make another buck. I have no motivation to do that at all, being a busy person with another job. My only motivation is really to put good stuff out there that people will benefit from. So that's what I can say about that.
That's great. Well, I've seen you at the table and it was great, but I haven't seen your penguin live. So I think I'll go and watch that. That'd be really good. I'm going to finish off the interview now, but I have to ask you one final question.
Okay.
It's got nothing to do with magic, but when I was researching you and I was just doing a little bit of research when I knew that we were going to be doing this interview, I read something very interesting on your website, which I'd just like to ask you about.
Okay.
It's eating a bagel. And apparently eating the bagel, we had maggots, and it sounds horrific.
It was a quiche, not a bagel.
Quiche. Sorry. Can you
that's okay.
Tell me that story? Because it was one sentence on the on the website, and I was like,
yeah,
what?
Yeah, it's an easy question. If anyone asked me, you know, what is like the most horrific experience you ever had in your life, that's an easy one for me. And it was so horrific that, yeah, I like to share that little tidbit. But you're right, I never really told the story before. I just allude to it sometimes on my website, etc. So here's the story. I mentioned earlier, I spent some time in France. I've probably been to Paris about 7 or 8 times, and twice was for a month at a time. And one of the times I was living in Paris, or maybe it was just visiting, I don't remember, but I went to some little cafe off the beaten path, and you know, it did something probably should have been suspicious about it. It looked like not many people were going there, and the food didn't exactly look like it had been cooked that morning. But I tend to be a trusting person, and I just sort of assume people are selling stuff that it's edible. So, and I was hungry, so I was like, I don't care. I just went in, and I love quiche. All right, I used to. And so I ordered a quiche. I think it was supposed to be bacon and ham, or no, I don't know. It was some kind of bacon-based quiche. And I bit into it, and I was like, that tastes really nasty, actually. What the hell kind of bacon is that? You know, I was like, there's something wrong with this. And then I looked down, and there were worms crawling out of the middle of this quiche. And some of them were half worms because I had already swallowed them. And you know, they were maggots, little worms crawling out everywhere. And I was like, so freaked out. It's hard to, I mean, as you can imagine, I felt so sick to my stomach. And I just couldn't believe I just swallowed that. And I'm looking at this thing, and it's like no take backs, right? You just want to be able to redo that moment. Like, no, please let me not have swallowed that. So I just went home, went back to my, room and laid down and felt really sick. And it took me many years to be able to eat quiche again. But luckily my wife's a really good baker, and she makes great quiche. I have great confidence that she's not gonna leave it laying around for a month, getting maggots going through it. So I've returned to eating it, but it was definitely an experience.
Whoa, my gosh. I've never heard anything like that before ever. That's, I don't even know what I'd do. I don't even know what I'd do in that scenario. That's just terrible. Oh my gosh. And you obviously never went back to that cafe ever again.
No. That's one thing. Of course, they don't get a second chance. Not that I'd be able to find it anyway at this point. I just staggered back to my room and laid down, and I wouldn't be able to find it again. But yeah, I need to use better judgment. I'm too trusting, I think. So,
yeah. My gosh. What a way to end an interview. Matt, it has been...
Speaking of which...
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a real pleasure and a real... It's really been fantastic having you on the show. I know how busy you are, I know that you're incredibly busy. We've talked about it, and just the fact that you've managed to spend time to come on here, I really appreciate it. And on behalf of
it was delightful.
And on behalf of the Magic community, please carry on creating. And even if it takes you 10 years, at some point, please bring out that sequel to the Buena Vista Shuffle Club, because the first book was amazing. So I'm sure any follow up would be amazing as well.
Thank you so much, Craig.
No
pleasure problem. Spending time with you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And guys, don't forget to subscribe to the channel. I'm back next week, I believe, with Justin Miller, I think, next week. So check that out. And I'm back tomorrow with Ryland on a review show. So I'll see you then. Thanks very much. Take care. Bye, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast.
Magic.
Be sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel,
Magic TV,
which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV, or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.